Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, here's a category of films you know I'll love. Movies about reporters, good reporters, bad reporters, the crooked, and the well-intentioned. The DVD gurus are in the house to run through some of their favorites. We'll get to Absence of Malice, Ace in the Hole, The Night Stalker, and His Girl Friday, and maybe a whole bunch more, too. The DVD gurus are Mitch Bryan, who's a screenwriter, UMKC film prof, and he's a writer for 435 South magazine. And Mitch, always good to have you.
Great to see you.
Happy Friday. Jason Heck is a film reviewer and one very good-looking man. How are you, buddy?
How you doing, little lady?
Nice to see you.
You look
nice
great
to
today. I like your tie.
Well, good selection of films here. Hard to pick out films on journalists, or is there a whole bunch to go with here?
It's a hard category just because for so many years, the reporter was the beacon of truth, you know?
Yes.
The dogged pursuant of justice. And it's so interesting because now when you think about reporters, it's not the same.
You know,
I was watching that movie,
Tell Me About the Campaign,
last night, right, with Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis. And all through it on the movie, Wolf Blitzer and who else was on it? And Chris Matthews. And I was just thinking, you whores, you're supposed to be reporters. You're supposed to represent truth. And you're in this silly movie taking a paycheck. You know, it's like, what's a reporter these days? Harvey Levin with his big gulp on TMZ.
TMZ is what I was thinking.
Who do we admire anymore?
The Wall Street Journal had a list of professions, occupations in the paper this week. You know, number one, the best job. Number 200, the worst job in the world. The number 200th job, the worst job on the list, was reporter.
Wow.
201 was radio host, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that was the audible bottoming out of the list.
That would be my life. There you go, the bottom two.
But look at what we've come, you know, before we had, you know, these guys working sources and chasing stories and crafting them and honing them. And now, with the media cycle, you know, you tweet a car accident and you're a reporter, or at least that's what people think.
Right.
So that's why we kind of think of old and new media, and old media is slow and old, but it's also important, right? I mean, old media are the people who tell us why we should vote for something, why we shouldn't vote for something, keep city council honest or in check. These are the people who are supposed to keep politicians in check, as opposed to catching some dumbbell candidate saying macaca and with your camera phone, and all of a sudden he's in trouble. So it's I think there's been an audible crumbling in that particular edifice.
And Hollywood is reflecting that, you're saying.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that whether, you know, Hollywood always reflects the popular culture. So I know there was a time when that truth-seeking reporter became a cliche. I can remember in pitch meetings, you know, people saying at a certain point, you don't want to do a reporter story. They've been done to death, you know. So who fills that vacuum, or how do you deal with the whole idea of reporting? And I think that's one of the things that you'll see over the continuum of the movies that we talk about today, how this representation of the reporter has changed. And in some ways, you know, I think that All the President's Men, which we're going to have our – you know, we're going to all screen together at the Alamo Drafthouse on Sunday.
2 o'clock on Sunday.
Was the pinnacle, you know. It was that point where everything really changed.
Well, and I'll talk on Sunday about how that film, you know, helped drive me into journalism. I walked out of the, you know, theater after seeing that film. That I can still remember the moment, and my eyes just, you know, 18 inches wide. I just was absolutely enthralled with that film and what it represented, for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You told me you threw away the matchbook with the truck driving school phone number on it and decided
it was
going to be journalism
for
you.
I'm going to make something out of my life.
I remember. Yeah. I remember. And it all the more impactful because, of course, it was real. That's, you know, all of these, you know, what we're talking about is, with one exception in Mitch's case, we're talking about fiction. But when you have something that is as powerfully done and expertly executed and with such amazing attention to verisimilitude as you have with All the President's Men, it makes the movie, you know, that much punchier, that much more resonant.
Yeah. And just what we're talking about, to bring everybody up to speed, we're going to do a special screening of All the President's Men this Sunday at 2 o'clock. I'll be there. Mitch and Jason will be there. We'll discuss the film just briefly before the viewing of it. That'll be Sunday at 2 o'clock at the Alamo Draft House downtown. We'll give away some tickets later on this hour so people can chime in and try to win some tickets.
Obviously, tickets are always on sale at drafthouse.com. You can reserve them and stuff. The Alamo has a great website that's very intuitive and easy to find stuff. Just move the schedule ticker over to Sunday, and hey, presto.
Okay. Let's go to our list of films here. Jason Heck, let's begin with yours, and your first one is His Girl Friday.
Yeah, and Mitch will definitely contribute on this one because he's going to be showing it to his class. His Girl Friday is, in a lot of ways, the ultimate Howard Hawks film. And we've done a show on Howard Hawks. And, you know, his men and his serious movies are generally driven by a sort of instinctive professionalism. If you look at stuff like Rio Bravo, even Only Angels Have Wings. But when he does comedy, he's done screwball comedy. His Girl Friday isn't quite screwball comedy. Mm-hmm. What it is Cary Grant, who is honestly probably the most attractive human being ever put on the planet in this film. He was at the height of his powers. I think he was 35 years old in 1940. And he plays Walter Burns, the editor of a crusading type newspaper, but he's also quite a cynic. His ex-wife and former ace reporter is Hildy, played by Rosalind Russell. And she has left him and is going to be leaving the newspaper business and leaving him for a new man. She's had her divorce finalized. She's met a nice guy played by Ralph Bellamy, who's an insurance salesman from Albany. And they're going to set up a little a home, and he's going to sell insurance, and she's going to be a wife. And you only need to see her for 2 minutes to realize that this is never going to happen. She is so clearly not hardwired to be a housewife. This is the ultimate Howard Hawks woman. She cracks wise with the boys. She is smarter than most of them. She is driven. She is gutsy. She fences expertly with all of them, fends off various advances, knows how to get ahead, knows when to chase a scoop, knows how to get the scoop. And Cary Grant is, you know, her equal in every way. He is sort of her boss, but sort of begging her to. Well, they're chasing a story. There is an execution that's going to take place, and the execution has a little bit of controversy attached to it.
As you're describing Cary Grant, I can't help but think we had Diane Cannon, his former wife, in here a few weeks ago,
who was at the
New Theater Restaurant. And she describes in her book the first moment she met him face to face with a string of superlatives that would just leave you breathless. I guess he was just something else.
You look at him in this movie, and I actually had a Blu-ray of it, so he's crisper and cleaner looking than ever before. And your jaw just drops. Mm-hmm. And this is really, you know, before plastic surgery and Botox and you know, all that stuff. And you're just looking like,
yeah,
God just decided to form this guy into sort of a perfect image of handsome manhood. Mm-hmm. He's extraordinary. And so what we have is Cary Grant desperately trying to both bust up the upcoming nuptials and get Rosalind Russell back writing for his paper because she's the only one. She's his best writer. And it's sort of famous because Howard Hawks came up with this. Well, he didn't really come up with it. It was actually in the play, which was called The Front Page, written by Ben Hecht.
A former
newspaperman, which is kind of critical. But overlapping dialogue is the new thing. And this movie kind of came up with how to use it. And Howard Hawks said, when I was listening to people, I realized that they sometimes talk over one another and sentences don't always end. And he came up with this. But since this was before multi-channel recording, he came up with this incredible sort of technical solution. And that was he would have microphones on the set. He would have overhead mics. Hey, out there in Radio Land, I'm gesturing over my head. You can't see. But he would have overhead microphones directly above each of his principal actors. And he would signal to his sound guys to turn the microphones on and off up to 35 times in a single scene.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's actually kind of an amazing technical achievement as well. The movie is very beautiful to look at, sharp black and whites, very crisp. A lot of soft focus, of course, on Rosalind Russell. That was how they shot women back then. But the repartee is what it's good at. Mm. And it's this dialogue that is bing, bang, bing. It pops. It crackles. Men and women dueling verbally. Very smart men and women. People who would be introduced as a wit and raconteur. Well,
whenever I think of Cary Grant, I think of that quick repartee, you know. And
who defines sophistication more than Cary Grant?
Well, that's right.
I mean, we see a guy today, if he looks elegant, we either call him James Bond or Cary Grant. Right. And in this movie, he is immaculately outfitted in double breasted suits and looks flawless. But what we have here is this incredible dialogue that is so quick and these long takes. So you realize that these actors back then memorized pages and pages and pages of dialogue and delivered it flawlessly. So you have a lot more respect for them than you do for these people now who are very beautiful and probably skilled at their craft, but who only have to, you know, mouth dialogue for 5 to 7 seconds.
Sometimes I find those older movies a little bit hard to listen to because you're not used to having to focus on the dialogue as hard as you have to sort of pick up everything.
Right. When we watch movies at home, we tend to slough be distracted,
a little bit,
right? We're looking down into our bowl of popcorn or whatever. Now you have to focus to get everything out of the movie. You really have to you have to listen because they're talking over each other. And in the clip I have, we have the sort of this perfect example of it. Our clip is Cary Grant is being – Rosalind Russell is revealing to him that she is going to be leaving, and he thinks she's leaving for another newspaper. He thinks he's competing against a paper and is trying to bid for her loyalty, but in fact, he is competing with another man.
Hilly.
No.
Hilly, you're going to help me out.
Not a chance.
Just
don't bother me. Will you get going?
Get out of here, Duffy. I'm busy. Now, look, honey.
Oh, please, save your breath.
Look, darling, this will bring us back together again, just the way we used to be.
That's just what I'm afraid of. Any time, any place, anywhere.
Oh, don't mock me. This is bigger than anything ever happened to us. Don't do it for me. Do it for the paper.
Scram, Svengali.
If you won't do it for love, how about money? Forget the other offer. I'll raise you $25 a week.
Listen to me, you great big bumbleheaded bamboo.
I'll make it $35 and not a cent more.
Fuller, are you going to listen?
Well, good grief, how much is that other paper going to pay you?
There isn't any other paper.
Oh, well, in that case, I'll raise it off. You go back to your old salary. Like, how do you like that? Trying to blackjack me.
Well, I want to show you something.
I'm
it's
busy.
Here. It's a ring. Take a good look at it. You know what it is? It's an engagement ring.
Engagement ring?
I tried to tell you right away, but you would start reminiscing. I'm getting married, Walter, and I'm also getting as far away from the newspaper business as I can get.
That's from His Girl Friday.
And I can't recommend it enough. It is one of the great pleasures in American cinema.
Yeah, truly. That's great. That's great. That first film from Jason Heck, His Girl Friday. We're talking this morning about films about journalism with Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck, our DVD gurus. And if, by all means, if you have a recommendation for us for a film that you recall involves journalists and the film industry, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can drop us an email to updatedate@kcur.org or tweet us at @kcurupdate. Mitch Bryan, you want to talk about a film, Ace in the Hole.
Which I suppose is one of the first movies that began to throw stones at the idea of reporters. It's not glorified the way that His Girl Friday is. And it features in its lead Kirk Douglas, who, when you think about him, Spartacus aside, you realize that he was one of the first great anti-heroes in Hollywood. He was one of the first actors from almost – actually, his archetype was in place from his very first movie. Out of the past, he came off as this guy who is driven, determined, and will stoop to any level to accomplish what he needs to accomplish. And yet somehow we like him. And so he played a lot of these characters who were ultimately – redeemable, even though they were sort of horrible. And he would always find that thing. He said in an interview that if he was playing a strong character, he always wanted to find their weakness. Or when he played a weak character like Van Gogh in Lust for Life, he wanted to find their strength. And so he was always conscious of this dynamic. And in Ace of the Hole, he plays a reporter, a down on his luck, probably alcoholic reporter, who whose car breaks down in Albuquerque. And he goes to the local newspaper to try to get himself a job working for them, manages to score a job, but finds that the reportage required of him in Albuquerque in 1951 is not particularly exciting until a fella gets trapped in a mine. And he begins to use this story as this human interest story that he can parlay into a long career, big move. And in fact, probably isn't real interested in getting the guy out of the mine. You know, the longer he stays in the mine, the longer the story's going to go. This was directed by Billy Wilder, who had directed Sunset Boulevard prior to that and Double Indemnity, and he would direct Stalag 17. His films tend to have these cynical protagonists, you know, at the center of them. Somebody once described Billy Wilder as a man whose brain was filled with razor blades. That's how sharp he was.
What a great description.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And in this movie, the dialogue is really sharp. The characters are very, very clear. And one critic even said that this was a kind of disguised film noir because they're all driven by the most base instincts, you know, mm-hmm. and people get their comeuppances in this thing.
Yeah. You would think that journalism would be such a natural place for producers and directors to go. There's so many potential storylines that come out of the daily, you know, workings of a working reporter.
Absolutely. And so many of the great filmmakers came out of the newspaper business.
That's interesting.
Not only Ben Hecht, who was one of the top screenwriters in Hollywood, but Samuel Fuller started out, and in fact, the film Park Row is about his early days as a newspaper boy. He went all the way from being a newspaper delivery boy to a reporter.
So did I, by George.
Did you?
Dayton
there
Daily
you go.
News in 1971, 72. I was a master honor carrier, don't you know?
I thought you would have sold grit door to door, but that's good.
Were you on your bike?
I was on my bike. I used to, you know, take my Sunday paper. We pick them up at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday mornings. And when the papers were big, that thing would, you know, you'd be rubbing your fender, would be rubbing against your tire. You'd be trying to get that load of papers up to your, you know, your area so you could at least dump some of them and lighten the load on your bike. But it used to be cold. We used to ask mom and dad, you know, if it's really cold, will you get up, you know, will you drive us tomorrow morning? And my mom and dad were always like, nope.
It's your job.
Your job. You go. You know, and we had peacock hand warmers. We would jam in our – we used to get those for selling extra papers or getting extra subscriptions.
Oh, really?
You'd get peacock hand warmers and you'd stuff them in your coat. And those things were so wonderful because you use your hands a lot delivering papers. Your hands would get so cold. And those things were just – and then – now you got me going. And then
– this is the plan,
you know,
all
on
along.
Sunday mornings or on Saturday mornings, if you were doing the morning then, you go to the donut shop down the other end of Far Hills Boulevard from where I lived to, you know, to get donuts. And we get there right as the store opened up, and the windows would always be steamed up completely. You couldn't see into the store. There was so much steam. And you'd walk, you know, as a 11, 12-year-old boy, you walk into that bakery, and the smell of those donuts, you'd be hungry. We would never eat before we went out. And that would just hit you like a 2x4. And it was just the greatest thing in the world.
Fluffy fresh donuts down on Johnson Drive.
Say that four times fast.
Yeah, fluffy fresh.
Fluffy fresh.
On Johnson Drive. I remember it opens really, really early like that, too.
Yeah.
And in the winter, it's all steamed
God,
up on the windows.
It's the greatest. Yeah. You could smell it, of course, for two blocks riding up to it. And all the guys would get together, and you'd buy your thing of milk and you know, and then
you're tuned into Kansas City Donuts today on KCUR.
There you go. Well, after I would deliver my papers, this is how I got started in daily print journalism. I would deliver my last paper to Mr. Witte, and then I would go just right around the corner, and there was the Shell gas station, and I'd, you know, plug in a quarter or 35 cents, what it was. You buy a Grape Pop or an Orange Crush, and I'd sit and read the paper, which I thought was the greatest thing in the world. Sitting there in the corner of the all the guys at the gas station knew me, and that's just how I rolled.
That's amazing. as an industry, what's happening now is you know nothing short of apocalyptic, and how much you've seen it change.
Oh,
from what?
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things represented in all these movies is that if you watch these movies chronologically, you see the bullpen go from, you know, typewriters to computers or to word processors, then to computers. And it's so funny. Kirk Douglas walks in Ace of the Hole when he's trying to apply for the job. And one of the things about Billy Wilder movies is they're filled with great business, right? And actor business. And Kirk Douglas walks up, and to get the attention of somebody, he pushes the return carriage on the typewriter so it zips and dings. So it's like, well, that's pretty clever. So then a couple minutes later, he pulls out a match, reaches down, pushes the return again, and rakes it across his match to light his match and
that
light his cigarette.
Oh, you're
so
kidding
and
me.
That, and you're like, wow, that's even better.
That's
you
cool.
know? So they
that's cool.
they've topped that great bit, and that's what Billy Wilder's movies do all the time. He is so good with the way he directs actors to just find these organic things that then complicate, and you always
that's
feel like
cool.
somebody's thinking, you know?
Yeah. I wish I had seen newsrooms like that. You know, when I came along, they were busy and pretty crazy, but computers came along pretty quickly, and things got a lot quieter. And now they're like insurance offices instead of what you wish it was, which was Mr. Guswell's day, just, you know, crazy and nuts and people yelling copy and all that stuff when Hemingway worked in our newsroom downtown.
Yeah.
You know, it was that kind of thing. So, okay. Yeah. So we're talking about Ace and the Hole. What's the clip?
So here's the
here?
Clip. So he has been sent out to cover, of all things, a rattlesnake roundup. And that's the big story for the day.
That works.
And so he's riding out there with this younger reporter and talking about what would make it better.
It's quite a sight. 1,000 rattlers in the underbrush and a lot of men smoking them out, bashing in their heads.
Big deal. 1,000 rattlers in the underbrush. Give me just 50 of them loose in Albuquerque. Like that leopard in Oklahoma City. The whole town in panic. Deserted streets. Barricaded houses. They're evacuating the children. Every man is armed. 50 killers on the prowl. 50. One by one, they start hunting them down. They get 10, 20. It's building. They get 40, 45. They get 49. Where's the last rattler? In a kindergarten? In a church? In a crowded elevator? Where?
Give up.
Where? In my desk drawer, Fan. Stashed away, only nobody knows it, see? The story's good for another 3 days. Then when I'm good and ready, we come out with a big extra. Sun Bulletin snags number 50.
We did it. We did a show once downtown at Bartle at the Kansas City Sports Convention thing, and a guy put a couple of rattlers in front of me, and I don't like them. I don't like snakes, just so know that. And these two rattlers are like, you know, 15 feet away in the floor, and, you know, I'm talking to the guy. I've sort of turned my head away from the rattlers, and at one point he takes his, you know, snake handling thing, the curved bar thing, and he puts it under the table, and he taps my leg with it, you know, and I'm live on the radio, and I'm just about leap through the top of Bartle Hall. It became one of the ornaments on top of Bartle Hall. Remember that? That was a moment. Okay, that's Ace in the Hole we're talking about with our DVD gurus, journalism movies. Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Maggie from Overland Park. Maggie, you're on with the gurus. Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, I tuned in a little just a few minutes ago, and I was wondering, there was a movie with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau, and they're reporters, and I think this is like early 70s maybe, but they're using candlestick phones, you know, the old-time phones you hold and you put things, they're trying to do reporting, and they're trying to get the story. And I can't remember what the name of the movie was. It was a comedy, but it was, I barely remember.
Was that the Front Page?
That's it.
Yeah, it was like the third version of the Front Page.
Yeah, which the Front Page was originally made, and then they remade it as His Girl Friday, changing one character into a woman, and then they they went back to the original with Lemon, and then they did another version with Burt Reynolds too, and they changed,
switching channels.
Yeah, and they set it in a TV studio instead. Yeah.
Maggie, I wish you could have seen Jason and Mitch sort of conferring with each other as you were describing the film. Was it this? Was it?
They looked like a couple of bookies.
You know, yeah, the computers were working. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the K-Pros with 64K RAM were working really hard on this end of the table. Click, click.
I'm glad you called, Maggie. Thanks.
Thank you. Have
okay,
a good day.
You too. Take care. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or send us an email to update@kcur.org. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about Woman of the Year, Absence of Malice, The Night Stalker, Shattered Glass, and we'll talk a little bit more about All the President's Men, our special screening on Sunday at 2 o'clock at the Alamo Drafthouse downtown. Tickets are going, so you might want to go online to
Drafthouse.com
to get some tickets. And we'll have a giveaway for a pair of free tickets in our second half today. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. This is music to...
This is from Zodiac, I think.
Zodiac. Okay. We're visiting with our DVD gurus. If you missed yesterday's conversation with presidential historian, the great historian, Doris Kearns Goodwin, and what a great conversation that was, you can find that and the weekend to-do list. Just go to kcur.org. Monday on the program, Kennedy's assassination prompted the Secret Service to revamp how it worked. We'll talk with the agent who protected Jackie Kennedy about the legacy of that day. His name is Clint Hill, and he's the man who jumped on the back of JFK's limousine after the shots rang out in Dallas 50 years ago, I guess just a couple weeks ago. And let's give away a couple tickets now to our special screening of All the President's Men this Sunday at 2 o'clock. It'll be shown at the Alamo Draft House downtown. I'll be there. So will Jason Heck and Mitch Bryan. We'll have a discussion about the film afterwards. Again, Sunday at 2 o'clock at the Alamo Draft House. You can win a pair of free tickets if you call us right now and answer this question. What agency did Deep Throat work for in the federal government? Our number 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. You can also email us at updatedatkcur.org. Okay, let's continue our romp through movies that have to do with journalism here. Jason, how about Woman of the Year?
How about Woman of the Year? Watching one of the greatest couples in screen history fall in love is what we actually – that's the great privilege of this film. It was Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn's very first film, 1942. Hepburn had just hit it out of the park with The Philadelphia Story. She had a lot of power. She had a script written by her friend Garson Kanin, and went to Joseph Mankiewicz and said, listen, this is going to cost you $250,000. $125,000 for me, $125,000 for the script, and I want to be in it. I want to name my director and my co-star. Well, The Philadelphia Story being what it was, she was allowed to do it. She picked Spencer Tracy. She picked George Stevens, and the result was an amazingly great movie, a beautiful film, but you are watching Tracy and Hepburn fall in love while they make it, and it has so much it has so much oomph because of that, the romantic scenes together. But that being said, it's a great newspaper film as well. Hepburn plays Tess Harding, who is this amazing polyglot, brilliant columnist who meets with Eleanor Roosevelt and meets with FDR, and she tells you what you're thinking today. And, of course, Spencer Tracy, who is arguably, before Tom Hanks, the greatest everyman that the screen has ever seen, plays a sports writer named Sam Craig, who is just kind of doing his thing. And he's a middlebrow kind of guy and has middlebrow tastes. And despite there being very, very different people with very different backgrounds, they manage to fall in love and they get married. Well, they sort of get married because they get married in a way that fits Tess's schedule and that of her diplomat father. And it turns out that the marriage isn't much of a marriage because she's always on the go and she's always off. She's sort of like Meryl Streep. She spends about a third of her time just being honored, right? So she's sort of off at various ceremonies, and she sort of adopts a Greek war refugee child that she doesn't really show much attention to. And Sam is left at home to try and take care of this child and forge a bond. And finally, she is nominated and wins Woman of the Year, this great award. You know, they put her right up there next to Eleanor Roosevelt. But it turns out that Sam decides to walk out on the marriage and take the child back to the orphanage. And he says, you know what? Here's an angle I have. The Woman of the Year is no woman at all. Presto, the marriage is done. So we have this huge crisis. She then goes to another wedding, that of her father and her aunt, on her mother's side, different, not the same. He's not marrying his sister, folks. And then she hears the words spoken by the priest, and she finally hears them for the first time and goes back to try and win back her husband. I won't say how it happens, but I will say that it is not how Katharine Hepburn envisioned it. They made some massive changes to the ending of the picture. She wasn't really happy with them, and it's a little goofy and a little bit patronizing. So the ending is the weak point, but the movie itself is extraordinary. It is one of those wonderful 40s movies where there are all sorts of kisses shown in silhouette and wonderful crescendoing romantic music. But watching Tracy and Hepburn, watching the way she looks at him, and you realize this woman is falling for this man right in front of your eyes.
In real life.
And it's great. Mm-hmm. It's real. And so it gives it this emotional resonance that none of these phony baloney movies today have. Yeah. And I'm not saying that older is always better, but in this case, it's so real that it's great, and it has so much oomph.
What's the clip we have here?
This clip we have is a wonderful clip with her clearly falling for him. He has just come back from Chicago and come back to their New York apartment, and it turns out that she was also in Chicago, and they're going to have an argument, and then they're going to make up.
This is from Woman of the Year.
Of course, I had a feeling at the time. That's really funny.
What's funny?
I was in Chicago yesterday.
You were in Chicago? What are you? I don't get it.
A conference. The government called a meeting of all the meat packers, and I flew out.
What time did you get there?
About 1 o'clock.
How long were you there?
Oh, I left about 6:15.
Well, I got through about 5:30. We could have come home together.
Well, it just never occurred to me. There was so much going
on. Well, why didn't it occur to you? It would have occurred to me.
Well, I don't know why you're making such an issue out of it. How could I have gotten hold of it?
Call the press box at Soldiers Field.
I couldn't possibly have known that. So you see, your whole point's about nothing.
Well, the point isn't whether we could have got together or not. The point is that you never even thought of it.
How do you know I didn't?
You just said you didn't.
Well, all right. Yesterday, I wasn't anxious enough to be with you. So we're even.
How do you figure that out?
Because today you aren't anxious enough to be with me. If you were, you wouldn't waste all this time arguing.
Spencer Tracy, you lucky devil.
There you go.
Wow.
Woman of the Year. We're talking about great films, about journalism with our DVD gurus, Mitch Bryan, Jason Heck. Let's go to some phone calls. Other folks have recommendations as well at 816-235-2888. Judith from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking this call. I'd like to suggest a little discussion about the movie Deadline USA, starring Humphrey Bogart. It's about heroic efforts to save a newspaper and how important newspapers are for our, civic and democratic life.
Deadline USA.
I'm embarrassed to say I've never seen it. Have you?
I haven't either.
1952.
Oh, no.
Who directed it?
Sorry. You know, I don't remember right now.
Richard Brooks directed it.
Oh, who was also a newspaper man, by the way. Richard Brooks. Yes.
There you go.
Humphrey Bogart comes in, and they absolutely don't want this newspaper to die.
Yeah, that's a period Kim Hunter
between sort of Sierra Madre and African Queen, where I haven't seen as many of his movies as I should, so I'm embarrassed.
Yeah. Judith, when you stump a guru, you've
well
done something in life. Yeah, very, very well done.
Oh, well, I hope he sees it.
Yeah, no, it's on my list. It sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think you'll like it.
Thanks,
Thank you
Judith.
For taking my call. Bye-bye.
And congratulations to our first ticket giveaway winner, Chris Giefer. We'll give away one more pair in just a few minutes as we talk about great films, about journalism. And Mitch Bryan, turn to one here. I think I recall this one, Absence of Malice.
Yeah, from 1981. Sidney Pollack was really on a roll. I mean, he made so many terrific movies through in the 70s and through the early 80s. 3 Days of the Condor and They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And The Way We Were. And I really love Absence of Malice. He made it in 1981. Paul Newman and Sally Field are in it. And Paul Newman plays the son of a criminal living a private life as a liquor wholesaler. And because of a particularly overzealous prosecutor who wants to use him to try to give information on a murder, which he may or may not have anything to do with, he sort of feeds this information to Sally Field, who's a reporter, and she takes the information and she runs with it, not realizing that she's been essentially just pointed in the direction of this. And it leads
– I've been there.
And that's what I was going to ask you too. Yeah, it leads her in a direction that causes such a controversy around Paul Newman's character that before you know it, there's a labor strike and people are following him and he's suddenly thrust into the public eye, which is something that nobody – wants. And in fact, I think Newman himself was interested in the story because there was a similar incident with the New York Post where I guess they were causing a lot of trouble with him and they were printing stuff he didn't want printed and pictures he didn't want shown. So I think he had a personal investment in investigating this, which is, I suppose, one of the dark sides of a free press and this question of public figures.
Well, people, you know, use the press a lot, you know, particularly in campaigns. They want to get some candidate in trouble or at least distract him from his message for a while or from his game plan. And they'll stick a reporter on a story that's bogus just to sort of, get the reporter and get the other competing campaign off the beaten trail for a while. And it works.
And there's always, I suppose, this tension between on one hand, you want to sell papers and you want notoriety, and so there's a pressure on the editors in charge, I guess.
I think people really overblow that, though. I never felt pressure like to get a big story to sell papers. That was just never where my head was. It was you get a story if there's a story there, and you don't want to put something out that's not right. I mean, it just for me, that just was never a hard call.
And I suppose that's – you're working in an institution that's interested in journalistic ethics ice. Yeah, you know, I mean, you're not working for the New York Post, right?
It's one thing great about the Star. It's one thing great about the industry. That's, you know, that part of the industry, and it's branching off now in a million different directions with bloggers and blogs who don't care about that stuff, and so credibility becomes, I think, a big issue.
Yeah, and the internet has sort of democratized that in terms of
absolutely.
And I mean, you see it in everything, not just in news reporting. You see it in film criticism, for example. You know, anybody with a blog can call themselves a critic, and so
that's right.
It does put an extra responsibility on the reader to be critical about it. And I don't think a lot of readers necessarily – they saw it on the interwebs. It must be true.
That's exactly right. That's one of the big issues of our times. I think they see it somewhere and they think it must be true. And
so,
it's not.
So this clip I want to play,
yes,
which I want to get your opinion on, is a consult between the newspaper's attorney, their resident lawyer. I assume most papers have a resident lawyer.
Of course, yeah.
And what – can or cannot go into this article that Sally Field's character is going to write.
This is from Absence of Malice.
Let us assume that he is neither a murderer nor the subject of investigation for saying. Let us suppose that your story proves to be false on its face.
This story is true.
Madam, if newspapers printed nothing but truth, they need never employ attorneys, and I should be out of work, which I am not.
I read the file.
I'm not a whit interested in the facts. I'm concerned with the law, and the question is not whether your story is true. The question is, what protection do we have if it proves to be false? Now then, Mr. Gallagher is not a public official, nor is he likely to become one. Pity. Is he a public figure?
He's not going to sue, for God's sake. So what does it take to make him a public figure?
If I knew that, I should be a judge. They never tell us till it's too late. I must admit I'd be more comfortable if he were a movie star or a football coach. Football coaches are very safe indeed. Have we spoken with Mr. Gallagher?
We don't exactly call the mafia for comment.
Please, make the attempt. If he talks to us, we'll include his denials, which will create the appearance of fairness. If he declines to speak, we can hardly be responsible for errors which he refuses to correct. And if we fail to reach him, at least we've tried.
You know, I've had those conversations,
yeah.
Or I've been privy or heard other reporters who've been involved in those conversations. You know, it's, yeah, you know, how did you get this information? Is it possible? You have two sources. Could one source have been the source for the second source? And they both told you the same thing. You know, there's all kinds of things that you got to sort of work through. And I've been part of those conversations.
Does that two source rule still apply, or what's the journalistic rule on sources? I mean, do you have to something once?
If you're breaking news with a story based on one source, your editor is going to say, "Get me a second source on this thing, Buster," and
right.
You got to have a good second source, and they need to know who it is as well. Sure, absolutely.
So this question of the anonymity of the source, although obviously the paper can protect that if they want to, the editor is in on this.
Yeah, the Star has always sort of said we're not going to roll that way. We're going to name our sources most of the time, 96% of the time. Rare exceptions are made. Now, one issue I have with the Washington Post covering government, there's all kinds of anonymous sources saying this about one, you know, senator or that congressman. And I don't know if that just feeds this whole anonymity thing, culture in D.C., which I've never liked very much.
Which seems to just get – it gets the transparency gets farther and farther and farther away.
Right. And this clip we just played about from Absence of Malice is about New York Times versus Sullivan, the Supreme Court ruling that says if you're a public figure, then your level of protection decreases. You know, reporters can say more things about you and not – be in danger of losing money in a lawsuit as a result of it.
And I guess with the internet too, it's probably harder these days to determine when somebody becomes a public figure.
There's a whole
especially where there's a whole culture
based on that
people
that,
who
that
do
that
nothing
issue.
But be famous. They don't even
Absolutely.
Do anything.
Yeah. Okay. That right. film, Absence of Malice, we're visiting with our DVD gurus. We're talking about great films about journalism. Again, our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, and our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. In just a few minutes, we'll give out one more pair of tickets for this Sunday screening of All the President's Men at the Alamo Drafthouse. And Jason Heck, you're up next. You want to talk about a film. Its title is The Night Stalker.
Leave it to Jason to do the made-for-TV movie. Huh?
Yeah, there you go.
When Killdozer proves unavailable.
Yeah.
So, yeah, 1972, we have The Night Stalker, a TV movie that leads to one of the coolest cult character TV series of all time, Kolchak. The Night Stalker, which a lot of you may remember. We have Darren McGavin wearing his battered pork pie hat and seersucker suits and tennis shoes, chasing all sorts of weird things throughout the night, be they Yeti or voodoo curses or alien energy or you name it. However, the movie that led to it all was a vampire. We have Kolchak in Las Vegas, a little bit down on his heels. He had been with bigger papers. I think he was with the New York Times. And he has ended up in Las Vegas dating a showgirl. And a series of murders begin. We have victims who are exsanguinated and killed in sort of strange ways and have bite marks on the throat. And Kolchak begins chasing it down. This is the epitome of the crusading reporter. He has the entire establishment against him. And the establishment is played by some pretty heavy guys. You have Ralph Meeker playing an FBI agent, Claude Akins as the sheriff, Charles McGraw as the police chief, Kent Smith as a district attorney, and all of them are arrayed against Kolchak. Even at press conferences, he's the only guy asking really piercing questions and driving things along and keeping the story alive. And he's trying to phrase it as such by saying things like, so this man clearly thinks he's a vampire. But of course, everybody knows that he's really saying this guy is a vampire. Darren McGavin is so good. He is exactly the right person for this. And of course, Simon Oakland plays his editor, who will back him but is also being pressured to soft pedal the story, and who is constantly saying things like, Kolchak, get the hell out of my office, and you've got 48 hours to make sure that this story is bears some sort of semblance of reality, and don't talk about vampires, and you, Kolchak, this is not going to get you back to the Times. And it's a classic sort of butting heads relationship with a lot of mutual respect thrown in, but Kolchak is the ultimate, along with probably Lou Grant on television, the ultimate TV vision of the crusading reporter. He is constantly butting his head against authority. He's chasing ambulances. He is throwing tips to tipsters like the operator at the county courthouse and various morgue attendants. And, you know, he's buying these tips for $20. And finally, of course, as is in every episode, he's proven correct. Mm. But the authorities still have ways to make sure that, yeah, he's correct, but they don't have to budge or bend. It's great television. It's great writing. Richard Matheson wrote it, he who gave us I Am Legend, The Incredible Shrinking Man, and he basically shaped modern science fiction, wrote it. It is very sharp. It's witty. It's a little bit gory and very scary and very cool.
So when you watch movies like Night Stalker or Woman of the Year, Ace in the Hole, I mean, are you tempted? Were you ever tempted to want to become a journalist or a reporter yourself?
I think reporters are scum. I would never want to be one.
Do
or
not. Get out of here.
Did I ever want to do journalism? No. Did I always want to review films? Starting when I was about 9 years old, watching black and white movies, I knew I wanted to write about them.
Yeah.
I mean, that was always kind of what I thought would be my first best destiny, was writing about movies. And I just happened to sort of come along a few years too late to really dive into it like Robert Butler did at The Star or any of these other great film writers. But, you know, as to chasing down a story and working sources and stuff, no, I didn't want to do that. But I did want to write about film. That's for sure.
Okay. What's the clip we have here from The Night Stalker?
Our clip is honestly, it's one of the best clips I've ever pulled. It's great. It's Carl Kolchak.
You may say so yourself.
No, this is great. This is great. It's Kolchak first defining what a reporter is, and he is exactly the kind of reporter he's describing, and then dueling with his editor about getting that story out on the press.
Jim Duffy of the Chicago Globe once described a reporter as follows. Socially, he fits in somewhere between a hooker and a bartender. Spiritually, he stands beside Galileo because he knows the world is round. Not that it does much good, of course, when his editor knows it's flat.
Kolchak.
Shelley Forbes has got to be his fifth victim. Look at the way her dog was killed.
You'll never give up, do you?
What do you mean?
I mean, this is unacceptable.
Unacceptable?
Kolchak, I'm very close to firing you, even though the owner of this paper has a sore spot in his head for has-been big city reporters. I am tired of your pressure, Kolchak. I'm tired of the owner's pressure. I'm tired of the pressure from all around me to blow the story up on the one hand and keep it under wraps on the other. I am tired of being the middleman, Kolchak. Do you understand that? Can you understand that?
What do you want, Vincenzo? A testimonial from Count Dracula?
Out! Get out!
What is this out-out gal, get-out game we play? This nut thinks he is a vampire. He has killed 4, maybe 5 women. He has drained every drop of blood from every one of them. Now, that is news, Vincenzo. News. And we are a newspaper. We are supposed to print news, not suppress it.
Wow.
I love that clip.
Wow.
And I love the Night Stalker.
That's a clip. You seen that film?
Absolutely.
You like that?
You're kidding me. Many, many times.
Yeah. Let's go to Corbett from Independence. Corbett, you're on Up to Date with our gurus. Good morning.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was thinking of Citizen Kane.
Ah.
And, like, in the first part, like, where he's manipulating the papers and, like, he's totally, like, making up these stories that aren't true. And it's, like, then it's, like, they get to the end of it and he's, like, like, somebody's like, you lost $1 million this year. And he's like, well, this Raber keep going for, like, another 60 years. And I feel like it's kind of prophetic today almost. It's like, you get a lot of these people, it's like, you feel like they have all this money and, like, there's, like, no end to, like, the manipulation that they can do.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone whose name rhymes with Poopert Purdock, perhaps.
Yeah. There you go. There you go. Mitch Bryan, take us home with this edition of the DVD Gurus and talk to us about a film. It's titled Shattered Glass.
Yeah, and so from Kolchak, who's the reporter that nobody wants to believe, Shattered Glass is about a reporter who everybody wants to believe, much to the embarrassment of all of those people who wind up believing him. It's based on a true story about a writer for the New Republic named Stephen Glass, who turns out of his 41 stories that they printed, 27 of them were made up.
Wow.
And it's all about the gullibility of people in a magazine that is trying to increase its sales. The question of what is a magazine supposed to do versus what a newspaper is supposed to do. No one tries to fudge. No one says he should fudge. But nobody wants to look too critically because these stories he tells are just so darn good, you know?
Mm.
It's written by Billy Ray, directed by Billy Ray.
If they're too good, you always question them.
Exactly. But what's wonderful about the movie is for the first – you know, you watch how this guy manages to manipulate everybody around him. And at first you believe these stories. And very quickly though, into the picture, you start to realize that something's not quite right about this. And he kind of gets spotted by a rival paper or a rival magazine across the country. And then you start to wonder, is he being fed this information or is he making it up?
Hmm.
And so they actually go into detail about the fact-checking process and how he circumvents it, which I thought was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. And great embarrassing moments, you know, when you know it's just about to crumble under this guy and like, how is he going to hold it together and have you no shame? You know, are you a sociopath? What kind of a person is this?
What's the clip we have for Shattered Glass?
So this is one of the scenes where he begins to pitch one of the stories, the last story that he did, the one that ultimately collapsed underneath him, and you get a sense of what kind of a storyteller he was.
The guys at Juke decided that it would be cheaper to hire him as a security consultant than it would be to try to stop him. So they met with him last week at the hotel where the National Hackers Conference was taking place. It was the chairman from Juke, Restel, Restel's mother, and Restel's agent.
No.
Yes, hackers have agents too. All right, I was at the table with these guys. Restel's just laying out all of his demands.
I want a Miata.
I want a trip to Disney World.
I want X-Men comic book number one.
I want a lifetime subscription to Playboy.
And throwing Penthouse.
And they're complying with every single word.
Excuse me, sir. Pardon me for interrupting. We can arrange more money for you and you can buy the comic book yourself. And when you're of a more appropriate age, you can buy the car and pornographic magazines on your own.
Cool.
After that, after they have the meeting, he goes back into the conference where all these hackers have gathered. And they're treating him like he's a rock star.
And one of the things that you heard there was that the audio was changing because it switches back and forth between a cinematic representation of the story he's telling and him telling the story. So you're not quite sure whether we're getting the truth or whether this is fiction.
Well, before we say goodbye, let's have one more free giveaway here for a pair of tickets for this Sunday screening of All the President's Men. 2:00 Sunday. I'll be there. Jason and Mitch will be there as well at the Alamo Draft House downtown. If you can answer this question at 816-235-2888, name a current day building next to the Watergate complex, which, of course, ties in with our film, All the President's Men. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. I want to thank Mitch Bryan and Jason Eck. You guys are great. Thanks for coming in again.
Our pleasure. We'll see you Sunday.